Welcome back to Season 9 of Talking with Traders. We're into the fifth year of this podcast that began in 2020. Once again, IG have come on board as the sponsor of the podcast. We're truly grateful to have such a global leader in online trading as our sponsors. In the coming weeks, I'll be interviewing various guests from around the globe on the topic of trading. Some of these will be past guests that we invite back onto the show, and some will be new guests. The idea is to attract a broad spectrum of different perspectives from various players in different areas of the markets. None of what you hear here is financial advice, but it is intended to get you thinking about how you might be able to apply what you hear here to your own trading and investing. Remember to subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast app. That way, you'll be notified when new episodes are released. Or if you watch these interviews on YouTube, please subscribe to our YouTube channel and give us a thumbs up and leave a comment if you wish. We welcome the engagement. Once again, thank you to IG for sponsoring this podcast into its fifth year, and thank you, listeners, for your continued support. Now, let's get on to this week's interview. My guest for this week's episode of Talking with Traders is James Eaton from The Trading Lab. He's a private trader, got quite an interesting backstory, and I'm really, really looking forward to speaking to you, James. Welcome to Talking with Traders.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm really excited to get into it. I just want to say as well, just as a quick caveat, I have done interviews before where I've been told that I do have a propensity to speak very, very quickly. So I just want to put that out there now. So yeah, people can kind of like be prepared for that, but.
All right. Yeah, I know you speak very quickly. And if it's possible for the listeners to slow their sound down to whatever 0.8 or whatever, then do that. Otherwise, we'll just crack on. But I'm looking forward to speaking to you because I have watched a number of your other interviews and very interesting, very insightful. So I've got lots of questions that I'm going to pepper you with over the next 45 minutes or so, James. As a start, I always ask this is, you know, how long have you been trading for and what got you into markets in the first place? What's your background?
Okay, so I first got involved in trading and in financial markets back in 2016. So, you know, 8 years ago at this point. And I fell into trading completely by accident, right? It was not an intentional decision on my part. I fell into it completely by accident. I was working as a personal trainer at that point. And, you know, I'd been a PT for a few years and I had a little bit of money that I sort of put aside. And I knew enough to know that I should be probably doing something with that, even though I was only 22 at that point. So I decided that I was going to invest in the stock market. And in kind of learning about the investing side of things, I very quickly came across the trading stuff. And I came across Tim Sykes, who was big on penny stock trading at that point. You've probably heard of him. And then I kind of just fell into trading that way. And then over the next kind of 6 months from first discovering it, I kind of gradually sort of fell in love with the idea of being a private, you know, sort of trader. But I will say that as well, you know, I didn't discover trading. It wasn't love at first sight. You know, I didn't, some people, it's like they see it on day one, they're straight into it. You know, it was a gradual process of about, as I say, 6-7 months before I fully sort of said, this is what I'm going to do.
But okay, yeah. Interesting. So personal trainer, I mean, that's what I guess is nice about that is that being a personal trainer, you're not always busy all hours of the day, are you? Or I suppose some might be, but I would imagine you've got a bit of free time during the day between sessions where you can look at the market and trade a bit. So it's something you could almost pick up part-time whilst still fulfilling your role as a personal trainer?
Yeah, absolutely. And I was quite lucky in that sense because I was doing in my developing stages, I was doing 5-6 hours of dedicated study a day between my clients. And that's because most of my clients were on the weekend, obviously, which was when the markets were shut, which was ideal. But even in the weekdays, I was always able to find a way to kind of fit it around my business quite effectively. So, yeah, that helped.
Okay, super. And just also so that I know, are you a trader now that eats what you kill? In other words, are you reliant entirely on your trading profitability to keep food on the table? Or do you have some other sources of passive, well, not passive necessarily, but risk-free income sources that help you pay the bills and get by every month?
Yeah, so obviously I do have other secondary income sources outside of trading. But I'll have my trading education business, but I'm a trader through and through, you know, and I always have been. I was trading for 3-4 years before I ever got into the education side of things anyway. And, you know, 90% of the profit that I make, the money that I make is what I make from trading. I do have a couple of other side things on, you know, outside of that, but trading is my bread and butter income.
Okay. All right, super. And psychologically, that's interesting because it's knowing that your ability to pay the bills and pay the rent and et cetera, is heavily dependent on whether you are profitable at the end of the month is quite a big psychological burden to wear, I would imagine. It's not for everybody.
Yeah, I mean, in the first sort of few years where I went private, when I actually scaled back from PT, which I was still obviously making an income from, I did exactly that. I was relying every month on having to make profit, on having to make money to pay, to pay rent and to pay expenses. Whereas now, certainly as I've scaled my account from, way back then, I'm not thinking monthly. I don't think that I need to make X percentage or X, X amount of R to make to pay for my lifestyle. I do everything on a quarterly basis, so I only pay myself every 3 months. Whether I make, 10 R in month one and then whatever, it has no bearing, and that also serves as a great psychological tool as well, because I'm not thinking, oh, I have to make profit this month, or if I make 10%, that's going to be a much. I just literally, I get to the end of the quarter, I review what I've done, I pull out 3 months' worth of living expenses, and then I trade for the next 3 months, and that's I just rinse and repeat like that.
Okay, fantastic. It's good to hear that because that's often the way I sort of also like to think about it is, block it up into periods. I always thought 1 year ahead, but you say quarterly. So you know that whatever you're doing now is for the following quarter. You've already got this quarter covered. There's no stress in terms of coming to the end of the month and suddenly the cupboard is bare.
Yeah, exactly that. And as well, and it's also from the other stance as well, because you can have months where you do fantastic. And obviously, we know that probability and variance play a huge role in trading results. You can have 1 month where you make, let's say 10%. And then month two, you make 2% or break even or whatever. Or maybe month then three, you then lose. So whilst it's been pretty consistent at maybe like 3% a month over the quarter, in that 10% month as it's happening, you don't know that. So you might then pay yourself more, you might treat yourself a little bit, and then obviously it slows down. So it just allows me to kind of give variance a chance to play out before I start paying and making financial decisions. I let the quarter play out, I assess how I've done, I pull out 3 months' worth of living expenses, and as I said, I then trade again.
Okay. All right. Excellent. And what do you trade, actually? You mentioned that you started by looking at penny stocks in the early part of your career, but what do you really focus on nowadays?
Well, I will say the penny stock phase was very much short-lived. I never actually delved too far into that. It was just sort of like Tim Sykes. That was one of the catalysts that kind of got me discovering more about trading. But nowadays, I trade Forex and commodities. I
Okay.
will trade cryptocurrency if there's some sort of significant opportunity that I think is there. I will trade the US indices, but 90% of what I do is concentrated on currency pairs and gold and oil.
Okay. All right. So that's interesting. Forex obviously is a 24-hour market. And how many Forex pairs do you follow?
My universe of tradable forex pairs is 28 different markets, which is the eight major currency pairs and the combinations that they produce. But I'm not actively trading those on a daily basis. Every single week, I take a concentrated list of 6 to 12 markets into any 1 week. So whilst I will scan through those 28 every Friday to then see what I'm trading, I'm only on a weekly basis trading, as I say, 6 to 12 of them.
Okay. All right. I'm interested to get into the weeds a little bit more about this as a Forex trader. I don't trade a lot of Forex myself. I mean, I look at it, I've dabbled in it here and there, but I've always been more of an equities guy. What I find sometimes tough with equities is the overnight gaps that you get, especially in the US around earnings can be insane. Whereas Forex doesn't really give you that, or not really. It doesn't. It simply doesn't because it's a 24-hour market. The moves are not as extreme and you don't get these enormous overnight gaps that can either make you weak or wipe you out. Can you take me through the process? I'm very interested to see what gets you to that point where you say, well, you've got six pairs that you're kind of focused on this week. Can you take me through from start to finish what the methodology is to get to that point and almost walk us through an example of a trade?
So you mean how do I narrow that list to 28 to say 6 or 10 or whatever it is?
Yes, exactly. What's like, I presume you start on a sort of a bigger picture view and then narrow it in, but can you walk us through that process?
Yeah, I mean, when you hit the nail on the head, it's all about the bigger picture perspective. So I'm very much focused. I've talked about this a lot in the past. I'm very much very heavy on multi-time frame analysis and trading from that bigger. That higher time frame. So even though I execute, I've got four execution time frames: the hourly, the 15-minute, the 5-minute, and the 1 minute. When I execute a trade, it's always predicated off of the relevant higher time frame to it. So if I execute on the 1 minute, I'm really trading the hourly chart. If I execute on the 5 minute, I'm really trading the 4 hour chart. If I execute on the hourly, I'm really trading the daily chart.
Right.
So when I create that list and I go through those 28 different pairs, I'm starting on the higher time frames, which for those trades will be the 4 hour and the daily time frames. And I'm looking to establish if there's any clear clues, any kind of like reason to believe that there's a stronger directional bias to that particular market. And there's four different criteria that I can look for and assess. And I use that same system to then actually grade my trade. So I can actually, because obviously no trade is made completely equal, right? You can have, within the remit of my strategy, you can have an A graded trade through to B, C, and then D trade. And when I look through that watch list, I'm looking for higher time frame structure that would give it an A or a B rating. And then that way, if I find an entry within the week and I find one of my two entry models on one of those markets, I know by default it's a high probability trade. So an A grade trade would be a market which is supported by higher time frame structure. And there's very particular sort of things that I look for in the market to identify that. But effectively, its structure is a series of things the market's produced that would give me an indication there's likely going to be a sell-off in the case of a short trade, or obviously a buying pressure coming in the case of a long. That would be an A grade trade, right? That's my bread and butter sort of setup. That's what my preferred setup is. For a B grade trade, I'm looking for higher time frame trend. So there isn't any structure present, but we have got a series of higher highs in the case of an uptrend, or a series of lower lows in the case of a downtrend, right? Classic technical analysis. So that would be a B grade trade. And then I have a C and D grade, which would be higher time frame momentum. So in the absence of structure or a trend, there is just a little burst of momentum that's in my favor. Or a D graded trade, which I would never take, would be a high time frame that's not got any support to it. There's no clear established high time frame direction, or if anything, it's actually counter to the higher time frame, i.e.,
Okay.
you're going long in an overall downtrend or vice versa.
Okay. So, from what you're saying, it sounds like you're always aligned generally with the direction of the higher time frames. So you're not trying to fight trends. You're trading with the trend. You're looking for the direction of momentum and just looking for an opportunity to get on board. Like catching a bus, right? You know where the bus is going, or which direction it's going, and you're waiting for it to stop and the doors to open. Get on it and go along in the direction.
Literally couldn't have said it better. Yeah, exactly that. Because I used to fade markets back in my sort of earlier stages. I would trade counter trend, and I just found that if you why not make your job as a trader as easy as possible? If I'm seeing a colossal uptrend or a market that's producing a very clear structure that we're going to see, excuse me, buying pressure come into the market, why not just trade long? Why not just literally trade in that direction? And when I kind of realized that, that's when I really kind of like started maturing as a trader, because I kind of realized I don't have to try and trade every move. I certainly don't have to trade in markets that are just choppy and sideways and there's no clear directional bias. I can just find the markets that are producing clear signs that institutional capital is going to come in, that we're going to see one of those movements, which, of course, when you are trading the Forex markets, where 90% of the liquidity is provided by financial institutions, that's really, really crucial. So yeah, as I said, I look for A or B structure, which is either, as I said, a defined pattern or structure that would indicate we're going to see institutional capital come in, or a defined trend in either direction. I then tag those lists, broken it into long and short, and then that is the list I take in.
Right. Okay. So you start the week with basically an idea of what your watch list is, what the direction of these Forex pairs are. Like let's just say, for example, right now, cable dollar pound is generally trending lower. You know that that's there's an opportunity potentially to short that pair, and then you'll zoom in and look for the opportunities to try and get on board that directional trend. Yeah.
Exactly that. All my work is throughout the week is then just scanning my predefined watch list to see if any entries are presenting in the direction that I want. And that's why nowadays, my total chart time, certainly since I had my daughter 2 years ago, my total chart time is no chart time is no more than an hour a day, because it's that mechanical. It's just scan my watch list, see if there's any entries in the direction that I want, and that's then it.
Yeah. So how many trades do you think you do in an average week? And I know that this is always a difficult question for traders to answer because some weeks present more opportunities than others. But I guess what I'm really trying to get at is, are you trading multiple times every week, several times in the day even, or are you trading very infrequently in the point where, it could only be one or two trades a week?
Like you say, it's obviously difficult to kind of give a blanket answer, but it really does depend on the context of the market and the opportunity that's being presented. I mean, it's Thursday when we're recording this, and I've currently only taken two trades for the week. Last week, I took seven, and that was certainly a much towards the higher sort of frequency of trading activity. I would say if I had to give an average, probably three, maybe four trades a week.
Okay, so very, very inactive actually. And I think that's an interesting lesson for listeners to this podcast because I think a lot of people have this idea that the term trader is some person who sits in front of the screen, they're hunched over a screen all day, every day, bashing away at the keys, buying and selling hundreds of times per day. And okay, there are some traders that do that, but a lot of the time, and certainly from many, many traders that I've interviewed, actually less is more. The fewer trades that you can do, the better. And the higher probability trades, the better.
Absolutely that. And I think one of the most powerful things you can do as a trader is doing nothing. I genuinely stand by that statement because, if you think that an avoidable loss is literally profit that you could have otherwise have made, if you treat it like that, then when you just stop taking those lower quality entries and you just start instead focusing on higher probability trades pro trend or pro structure, that's when I do think a lot of people will revolutionize their trading. I did a lot of coaching clients back a couple of years ago, and when I worked with clients one-on-one, one of the first things that I'd always see is that they're overtrading, and we could almost always, just by recalibrating the results and taking out the avoidable losses, the lower quality trades, they would almost always be profitable. They just kept the remaining activity, if that makes sense.
Totally. I mean, that's it. I've also always said to my clients that I sort of mentor or coach, it's that, just take out your worst losses and look at how your account would look then. It's a game changer. So you've got what sounds like a relatively systematic process, or you've got your rules, you've made the rules, you've put them in place, and you're disciplined enough to adhere to them. Do you ever fall into the trap of using your discretion to override your system, or is it pretty hard and fast, systematic based?
I would say 99% of what I do is mechanical and rules based. There is always that slightly more qualitative element in any trading strategy where you can say, well, there's that, you might override something this time or just do something a little bit different, but that is very, very rare. If you were to go into my trade, if I literally pulled up my trade journal now, you would see it's the same series of rules being rinsed and repeated. And that's not just a case in terms of my actual entry models, my two entry models that I trade. That's in terms of how I allocate risk, how I define my watch list, how I absolutely every single part of my methodology is based around a rule set. And I really kind of gravitated to that idea of mechanical trading when I first was in my developing stages and I read about Rich Dennis and William Eckhart, who, if your listeners don't know, that they were two traders back in the 80s who create this turtle trade, what they call the turtle trading program, because they kind of created this bet as to whether profitable traders are born that way or whether they can be built. And what they effectively did over like a 6-week program, and I think it was only 2 weeks of that 6-week program was actually taught on technicals, but they taught them a very rules-based strategy, very simple strategy, just using moving average crossovers and whatnot. And they create some incredibly successful traders. And when I first read about that story, it kind of implanted this idea that it's not sitting in front of 12 different monitors, making kind of like decisions on the fly, using gut feel, using intuition. It could be this very robotic, mechanical sort of thing. And I like to kind of think of trading as almost like a bit like a recipe, right? I'm shit in the kitchen. I cannot cook to save my fucking life. But if you give me a recipe with step-by-step instructions and I follow that recipe, I can often get a good and often repeatable result. And I think trading should be exactly the same. It's just a case of go onto the chart, find X, Y, and Z. If you see X, Y, and Z, you take the trade. If you don't, you don't. And when you have that, it removes the possibility of inviting discretion and subjectivity into it. And that's just what I'm all about.
I love that analogy of using it like a recipe. It makes sense. I think I might steal that and use that from time to time in quotes. You talked previously about, understanding your risk and your R. And for listeners to the podcast who don't know what that is, the R is often the what it's a term that traders use to basically define their risk. One R is one unit of risk, and that's effectively what you'd be willing to lose on an individual trade. So in your world, James, what is R in terms of percentage of capital? And then I've got a few other questions that I want to ask from there, but what is one unit of risk in your world?
The one unit of risk for me is now 0.5% of my account balance, and that's what I
Right.
risk in any individual trade. Up until about 7, 8 months ago, that used to be 1%, and that's how I traded. That's the standard risk per trade model that most traders learn, right?
Yeah.
But up until recently, certainly, as I said, about not 8 months ago, I started scaling my account even further, and I just found that 0.5% was actually a much more a much better point for me. And I won't go too deep into why that is, because it's like, if you're profitable in one, why would you then reduce it? But any a lot of variables went into deciding that. But yeah,
Yeah.
I now trade with 0.5%.
I'm curious just to ask you why. I mean, I know you said you don't want to go into it, but I have a similar thing with trading. I've also found that over the years, as I've gotten older, and also as there's more responsibilities in life, and maybe you've built up an asset base or whatever, you suddenly find your risk appetite actually dwindles as you get older, and it should. Is that part of the reason why you'd scale back the risk a bit?
To a certain extent, it's not because my necessary because I sort of became less risk. I became more risk averse. It was more because it coincided with me scaling my account after another kind of like bump in investment, and with that, I sort of just felt more comfortable at that lower end risk model. And I kind of traded it for on almost like a sort of a trial basis. And after a couple of months, I realized that I actually traded and performed significantly better with less risk. And I don't have the hard and fast data, because I've been executing 0.5 for a standard now. But I would say that I actually make more profit at 0.5% than I do at 1%. And I know
Yeah.
there are going to be traders that are like, how the fuck does that possibly work? But I definitely would say that, obviously, sure, if I were to go back in my trade journal, trades that I would have executed with 1% are now obviously half. But there's any number of potential emotional factors that can kind of come in when you're trading with 1%. At 1%, let's just say I take five losses in a row, which every trader is going to experience. Maybe I do then hesitate on trade six. Maybe I do hesitate on that next trade, where I either scale back the risk and I then trade at 0.5% when I should be trading at one, or I miss it completely. And that's the difference maker that would have taken me back up to profit. And 0.5, I take five losses in a row, but shit, I'm down 2.5%. It doesn't even register on my emotional sort of radar.
Yeah.
So,
I completely get that. I completely get it. And that makes absolute sense. And I can also completely get why you make more money trading smaller positions than what you do, but trading bigger positions. It's often very difficult to trade bigger positions to stomach the movements, to stomach the volatility, and also to run winners. To run a winner on a big position is, obviously that's the dream, but it's bloody hard to do.
Absolutely that. And there's a great quote where it's like, the risk is the fuel you put on your emotional fire. And effectively, the less risk that you have, and it's funny as well, because I say less risk, obviously it's percentage less risk, but it is not quite the same in terms of the monetary amount, because it coincided with, as I said, scaling my account. It's not too dissimilar from the monetary risk, but as a percentage, it's just right for me. But I would say, if you're a beginner trader, I would say the 1% risk per trade model is probably about right. Which
Yeah, fair enough.
sounds completely backwards, why you a beginner would take more risk, but
Well, I think also beginners often start with smaller accounts, and
yeah,
actually
exactly.
you sometimes do need to actually it's not necessarily the textbook right thing to do, but sometimes you do need to swing the bat a little harder when you've got a small account, because otherwise you're not going to move the needle. If you've got a, I don't know, a £5,000 account and you're risking 0.5%, you're not going to move the needle. You almost do need to swing the bat a little bit harder when starting with a small account, almost to get you out of the starting blocks in a sense. But of course that does come with added risk as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think as well, when you're trading at 1%, you very quickly realize how quickly you can go into drawdown.
Yeah.
Like, you very quickly, you can be have four, five, six losses in a row. And
Well, this is it, right? Clusters happen, both good and bad clusters. And it, quite right, you could have, four or five. I mean, my worst cluster in my trading career was 11 in a row, where I got 11 trades wrong in a row. And if you're risking 1% or more than 1%, that starts to be mean a big drawdown on your capital, which affects your confidence and everything. You don't want to go there. So, what about multiple positions? Because you mentioned that you obviously you trade multiple different pairs. So 0.5% risk on an individual position. But how many positions do you allow yourself to have open at any one time? In other words, what's your maximum total permissible portfolio risk at any one time if every trade that you've got open suddenly got stopped out today?
The maximal permissible loss would be 3%, which previously was obviously 3.1% trades. That's now obviously 6%, which since I've been trading at 0.5%, I've never had 6 active positions open. Not because there hasn't been, because I wouldn't have, but just because that I've just never encountered that many potential setups to be executed. But yeah, if it did happen, 3%.
That's what would happen, right? And have you got historical stats on your win to loss ratio, and also then in addition to that, average winner relative to loser?
Yeah, so do you want my personal? I mean, so I
You
maintain what I call the master strategy spreadsheet, which is a log of every single trade which meets my strategy rules over 10 different forex markets,
Yes. Yeah.
and that's been maintained for over 4.5 years now, in which there's 3,500 trades in there, and the strike rate has always been consistently, whether regardless of what pair you look at or what time period, has consistently been just under 70%. With about a 2.8% average profit. And what I would say is that my trading is almost pretty much aligned in exact alignment with that. I would say my strike rate is probably slightly higher. But on the topic of strike rate, I will make it clear that my strike rate includes break-even trades as well.
Okay, so all right, that's an interesting point you raised there. So around about 70% are, well, let's call them winners, but so 30% are losers, right? But of that 70%, quite a large number are also break even.
Yeah, so I can very easily calculate that as well by removing break-evens from the data set.
Yeah.
Effectively, my strike rate is a trade that doesn't lose money, right?
Yes.
It doesn't necessarily make me money. And the reason why I decided to do that was because by default, if I take a break-even, that trade had to move to at least 1R. That's my criteria. It's not like I took it and it just moved above entry and then I closed out manually for break. It would have had to have reached at least 1R. So in other words, the setup, it did pop enough to play out. So when I'm looking at my strike rate, I want to see not how many trades am I going to make money on. I want to see the probability of the setup working. And that's more important to me. That's why I made that sort of decision to do that.
Okay, so just so I'm understanding it right, so the 30% odd that you're losing on those, never really saw much of a profit and they went and hit the stop loss, out, gone. Then there's a portion which actually broke even. However, at a time, those were actually winning trades where you were up 1R at some point but hadn't taken the profit, and then it declined back to your entry point essentially, so you ended up with a zero profit on that trade. What about then the winners? I mean, and I'm guessing that you've got some sort of methodology that allows you to trail a stop loss once it gets up beyond 1R.
Yeah, exactly that. I don't. A lot of traders obviously use take profit orders. I don't use TPs at all, or at least very, very rarely, unless I'm trading to support and resistance and there's a clear target as to where we should logically take profit. But 99% of my trades, I'm trailing the stop loss. And of course, because I'm already trading in markets where there's default a probability of higher time frame continued movement, that's why that management strategy works really well, because you can then just trail the stop loss as price moves in your favor. If I was cut off profit at 3R, I'm never going to have a 5R trade.
Yeah.
So that is always what made sense to me.
I guess that's it, right? You've got to give yourself the opportunity to actually have that big winner. You can't cut your opportunity off every time. Yeah. Otherwise, you're just not going to have it.
Exactly that. I mean, when I on the 30th of September, which was like 2 months ago at this point, I had a 15R trade.
Wow.
And prior to that, I'd had, I think, like a fair few losses and break evens. But if I'd come into that trade with, like, right, I'm going to just take it off at, say, 6R and not use that management method, I would never have caught 15R. But,
Yeah.
and it serves as a psychological tool very well as well, because you're always leaving that possibility that it can make further profit.
Yeah.
But you're also then saying, right, if it does pull back to X point in the chart, I'll take profit and I've banked at least whatever, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And do you not get bothered where a trade's gone to 1R and you've got a theoretical mark to market profit there, which is it's nice to look at, but then it goes back and you've now lost your winner. Does it bug you? Or do you just say, oh, that's part of the system, it's going to happen?
It doesn't bother me at all. Not like not even in the slightest.
Right.
I don't own any result until the trade's finished. So if it's at 1 hour, it might be running, 1 hour profit, but it doesn't. I've not owned anything until I've either locked profit in or it's not done until the trade's closed. So for me, it's
Right.
the what I expect to happen within the system.
Yeah. Okay. And your background as a personal trainer is interesting. And I was thinking about this, personal trainer, obviously that involves quite a lot of discipline, to keep fit, to do the right things. When one thinks of a personal trainer, you think discipline, you think consistency, you think long-term mindset, putting in the hours every day. Do you think those criteria, those sort of personality traits that drew you to being a personal trainer, are part of the reason why you've been successful as a trader? Are those skill sets or those characteristics overlapping?
I would say absolutely, because ultimately how you do one thing is how you do everything, right? We've all heard that. And when we talk about things like discipline and motivation, these things aren't situationally specific, right? Typically people that are very disciplined when it comes to their fitness regime or their business will also be very disciplined traders, or at least that's the experience, what I've seen. But I was already very disciplined and very self-motivated when I came in to personal training. It wasn't PT that made me those things. I was always a very much self-motivated sort of person, and I mean, I didn't have a lot going for me, but I can say for sure I was certainly disciplined and self-motivated. So yeah, I think they certainly helped, but they weren't cultivated in the fitness thing. They were very much already there. I mean, I remember being 7 years old, and one of the things that attracted me to trading when I kind of discovered it was that kind of prospect of making money. And I'd always been very much any scheme that could make money, I was interested in. I remember at 7 years old, I used to. Do you know the Avon catalogues? I don't
I
know if that's
don't know.
familiar.
So I mean, I'm from South Africa. So when I was that age, and which would have been when you were that age, similar sort of thing, I guess. I don't know that. So tell me about it.
Well, so it's just a catalogue that sold all sorts of different products, but in the back section there, you was like this lingerie and underwear section. Keep in mind, I know it sounds creepy as shit now, but I was like 7 years old at this point. And my mum, once she'd read it, she'd get the Avon catalogue and then she'd leave it on the side behind the garage, or just before when you get into the garage, so that she could recycle the catalogue. And when I discovered that there were like these like lingerie pictures in there, I used to cut them out and then take them to the boys at school and like sell them for like 30p or 20p or something. And I know that sounds bizarre now because this was before the internet would really kind of like taken off. Or if you did have the internet, it was in like it was in the computer in the front room or something. So I'd always been kind of like things like that. I learned magic when I was 14 and started forming magic tricks to the neighbors in my thing. So like those traits were very much already there. I mean, back to the point of what you said, the traits were already there, and I took them into PT and then they transcended into trading quite well as well. But
Yeah.
it's yeah.
Very, very interesting to see that thread that's obviously carried through your whole life to get you to this point. And do you journal? A lot of traders talk about journaling and how important it is. Do you journal?
Yeah, have pretty much from day one. Two things that I use to journal. So I've got my trade analyzer, which is a custom built tool in Excel, and that tracks the number side of the trading stats. So average stop loss, so my stop loss, time of the trade, the profit, the R, all of that sort of stuff. And then within that tool, there's a separate sheet which then breaks all those stats down, where it tells me my expectancy of the system, longest consecutive profit streak, longest consecutive loss streak, average R, all of that sort of stuff. The other tool that I then use is my actual trading journal, where I actually log trade screenshots and a little write-up. So I sort of write down what I'm seeing at the time and all that sort of stuff. And then that way I've got the qualitative aspects of the trade in the journal, so the screenshots of the trade, and I've got the quantitative stats side. So between that, I have a very comprehensive overview of two performance and all of that sort of stuff.
Okay. Interesting how this keeps coming up over and over. Those traders that are super successful generally do journal. It's interesting.
Have you, just out of curiosity, have you interviewed anyone that have said like, I just don't journal? Have you ever had that? Like, I just don't
There
have.
have been some. There have been
Okay.
some, but those are the exceptions I find. I think more often than not, I find successful, consistent traders do journal and like to kind of monitor their own statistics, monitor their own data and build up a huge data set that they can then analyze. and interrogate and utilize to try and improve. So it makes a lot of sense.
That's exactly. I also find as well, there's just accountability in journaling. You know, when I know that every single trade I do is going to get logged and get journaled, it can sometimes remove those more rushed trades, and even just the process of taking the screenshot on TradingView and writing it up. Sometimes that is just the very thing that crystallizes what you're thinking, and for you to go, do you know what? I'm being a fucking idiot. That's a stupid trade, you know. So yeah, it's very powerful, I think.
Okay. And can you take me through your daily routine?
So like what? From wake up to
Yeah, so your trading routine, like where, yeah, let's start with wake up. You don't have to tell me, too many details besides it's not, once you're out of bed, let's say from that point onwards.
So typical wake up, let's say 7 a.m. right? I'm not one of those traders that then jumps straight into the office onto the charts. Casual sort of, you know, hour, whatever. First time that I'm jumping the charts, let's say it's 7:30. My first thing that I do is just review that watch list, which obviously, as I've said before, is already predefined. And all I'm doing is just going through scanning to see if any of my entries are present. That actual time only takes 3 minutes. My morning routine, though, at the charts, it lasts a little bit longer, probably 15, 20 minutes, because I also do a little bit of visualization. I do some goal review. I'll update my Discord, all that sort of stuff. After that, I then have sort of six alarms set on my phone, which are set for, hopefully you can see those,
I can, yeah. 10, 12, yeah.
10, 12, 2, 4, 6, and 8. So they literally are set every 2 hours, and they're just little dings, little nudges that just remind me to check the charts when I get an opportunity. It doesn't mean that I stop whatever I'm doing at 10 o'clock, 2 o'clock, and then, you know, jump on, but it just means that, as I said, it's like just a little nudge just reminding me to do it. And then when those alarms go off, I literally just open up my phone on my laptop. I go again onto that watch list. I scan through it on the 5 minute chart and the 15 minute chart, see if any entries are presented, and then that's it. I think I said this before, my list is already as well split into long and short sections.
Right.
I already know what direction I'm looking to trade in. I'm just looking to see if one of my two entry models are actually on it. That takes 60 seconds, making my total chart time literally 30, 60 minutes.
Okay. All right. And the rest of the day, I mean, you've mentioned before that you don't like to be in front of the screen, and that a bit of distance from the screens is healthy. What do you spend the rest of the day doing? You still look like you're fit. I presume the PT hasn't left you. You still like to gym.
Yeah, I try to get into the gym 3 days a week. You know, I've got other hobbies outside of trading. I mean, I always say I came into trading to have more freedom, not less of it. You know, I know these traders like to. There are some that like to sit in front of six fucking monitors and, you know, have eight different charts open on the 1 minute time frame and try and capture every sort of single tick and every pip. And I can't think of anything worse. You know, I just couldn't, would never want to do that. Sometimes on a Friday, certainly when you see more intraday trends, I will be a little bit more active, and maybe I'll sit in front of a market if it looks like it's going to produce a nice scalp for 20 minutes and see if that entry produces itself. But I'm certainly not one of these guys that are in front of the monitors all day, you know, putting hours and hours and hours into it.
Okay. Okay. Mindset is a big thing, and I know you've got four pillars that you kind of focus on in terms of maintaining a healthy, positive mindset. Can we talk about that?
So the four pillars. I first mentioned these when I did another podcast with Trading Nut a few years ago, and we sort of took a more macro, sort of higher level look at them. But I think for them to really have value, there's actually, you know, it would help if I could actually give listeners a specific kind of way to actually implement that pillar. So would you want just to kind of run through the four pillars and kind of like
Yeah,
elaborate on them?
let's run through each of the four pillars, and then maybe you can give an example of where, how you'd implement it.
Okay, so pillar one is dealing with losses, right? I think that is just the most fundamental skill you can develop as a trader, right? Providing you've got the fundamentals down in terms of managing risk and all that sort of stuff. One of the most important things that you can do is learn how to fucking lose. Learn how to lose like a professional. And the way that we do that comes from the way that we view losses, right? Ultimately, as well, we can also allocate risk. How much we allocate obviously will determine how well we take a loss. But the biggest shift that will happen in how you deal with losses is the way that you view them. And two specific beliefs that I've kind of cultivated in regards to losses are the kind of a mission into the trading game. Right, I kind of like to sort of see them, not as like, oh shit, I'm down 1R or X amount of money. It's the price to play this game. You know, it's the cost of entry. It's the entrance fee into the game of trading. And unless you pay those losses, you can't participate. And if you don't participate, you can't make fucking money. So for me, it's like that. It's no different to an expense in my business. You know, I run a website, I have website costs, hosting, domain costs. I don't bat an eyelid when I pay those. In much the same way, I don't bat an eyelid when I take a fucking loss, you know? Then you've got removing the concept of money. So pillar two. So removing the idea of money within your trading. And this always sounds really counterintuitive to new traders because the whole point of trading is to fucking make money, right? If any trader says they're in trading for anything else, they're a fucking liar. So when you sort of say, look, you want to try and remove that idea, it does go against a lot of people's kind of thoughts. Whereas the reason why it's so important is because if you're looking at things through the microscope and through the lens of the pennies and the pounds, you're going to have a really tough emotional time when you do take a loss or when you do make. Because if you take, let's say you're trading, you know, a fund account, you've got 100 grand on your belt, you take a 1% loss, you're down a grand. Me, you know, like most people, that's not going to sit well with them. Certainly, you know, if you're that could have been X amount of your mortgage, or that could have been this payment. You know, it's just not going to work. So, the important thing that you need to do is view all of your results from the R multiple, which obviously we touched on before, and just, as I said, completely remove that idea of money. I don't even think about money until I get to the end of my quarter. I do my review, and then I actually pull some profit out. Other than that, it's just charts. That's it. It's just the R multiple and charts. I don't think of anything else. So that's pillar two. Then you've got pillar three, thinking in probabilities. Now, anyone who's read Trading in the Zone by Mark Douglas, which I would recommend every trader does read, knows that he's very big on kind of cultivating this probabilistic mindset grounded in numbers and statistics. And what that effectively means in a nutshell is understanding that there can be a guaranteed statistical result on a macro level, whilst also embracing a lot of variance and randomness on a more micro level. And one of the easiest ways that you can actually apply this is through what I call the 10 trade rule. The 10 trade rule is effectively just a tool that you can use that says you don't own any of your results. You don't think about percentages or anything until you've completed and flawlessly executed 10 instances of your edge. In other words, you don't own the two results, the two losses, or the massive profit that occurs in the middle of the block. You don't think of it at all until you've done 10 trades. Only then, once you've completed 10, 10 trades, are you allowed to say, okay, I'm up 6% or I'm down 2R or whatever. Until then, you're just focused on execution. And this way, it allows you to kind of give probability and variance a voice before you give your emotions one, because you're actually allowing the numbers to kind of play out before you start getting emotionally attached to the results of individual trades. In my course, I actually show an example of two different blocks of 10 trades that I executed. In block one, literally, bar one small profit sort of sprinkled in the middle, it was just losses and break evens. Then on trade 10, which was a scalp that I took in June last year, I made 10R. And the end ultimate result of the block was a total result of like 2.8R or something. And in block two, it looks much more like what you'd expect trading results to look like. It's kind of, you know, small losses, larger profits, and then a couple of break evens sprinkled in between. And whilst it was a lot more, as I say, what you would expect, it was actually less profitable than the first block. And if you allowed your emotions to kind of get the better of you within that first block, you know, and you experienced the despair that comes with taking loss after loss after loss, it meant nothing in the grand scheme of things, because after the 10 trades, it meant nothing. It literally didn't mean anything. So yeah, execute 10 times, then you're allowed to experience just if you're in drawdown, or then you're allowed to experience the euphoria of your profits. But until then, nothing but execution and process. And then finally, you've got pillar four, which is remaining relentlessly positive. So I think, I mean, you know, this is not even just trading to have, you know, a generally positive outlook on trading and results and that kind of thing. Otherwise, how are you going to put in the study and pursue it when you're not making any money, when you're going through that stage, when you're taking losses? You're just not going to have anything to hold you through. So you've got to have that generally kind of like good positive outlook on trading, that constant belief that you will be successful, that you will make it happen. And what I find is, again, mainly from working with clients, is that So many people spend so much time thinking about the worst thing that can happen. What if I pass? What if I fail the FCMO challenge? What if I get into trading and I fail? What if I prove my friends and family right that I'm just a fucking gambler? What if I, lose all of my money? And one of the things that I've done from a very, not from a very early age, but from certainly like a teenager, is I've always spent at least twice as much time pondering on the best out case scenario than on the worst case. So if
Right.
you're going, okay, what if I fucking blow the account? What if I lose the fee? What if I lose all my money? It's only fair that you say, well, actually, what if you pass the challenge? What if you make money? What if you're consistently profitable? What if you fucking change your life as a result of getting into this? Because it's only fair, right? And the reality is, most people, it's never really, they never really achieve either one of those scenarios. Normally, it's somewhere in between, right? But unless you're willing to entertain that best case scenario as well, it's not fair that you entertain the worst case. I mean, well, I've got a sister, for example, and I've been pushing for my sister for the past 4 years to create a business, a dog walking business. And all of my family, the first thing is like, but what if she fails? What if she doesn't do it? What if she leaves her job and then she does, and then the business fails? What if one of the dogs gets off a fucking lead and she loses one? What if it bites someone? It's like, what if it doesn't? What if she sets up the business and fucking creates a life doing something that she loves? What if she succeeds? What if she replaces her income from her day job? What if she, So that's what how I sort of see it. You've got to spend time pondering that best case scenario.
Yeah, so refreshing. So refreshing. I'm really enjoying this conversation, but I'm also conscious of the time, and we are kind of getting towards the end of the allocated time that we have for this podcast. So I'm going to wrap it up pretty shortly. But two more things. Books. I know you've read a lot of trading books in your time. You mentioned Mark Douglas, Trading in the Zone, which I think is also probably one of the best trading books ever written. Have you got, let's just say, one or two other recommendations in terms of your favorite trading books that you've read?
I mean, for a technical one, I would say The Art and Science of Technical Analysis by Adam Grimes, absolutely essential reading. And then I would say for a more mindset one, other than Trading in the Zone, is The Mental Game of Trading by Jarrod Tendler, I think his name is. But
Yes.
great book.
That's a great book. Yeah, I've read that. Excellent. All right, superb. And then final question is listeners to this podcast that want to follow your work or possibly, take your course, where do they get hold of you?
So for easiest ways, you can either go to my Instagram, which is James Eaton FX, literally James Eaton FX, no dots. Do be careful of the scam accounts out there that duplicate my profiles. If not, you can very easily go to my website, which is thetradinglab.online.
TradingLab.online. Okay, excellent. All right, James. Well, it's really been enjoyable speaking to you. Thank you so much for coming onto the podcast. It's been refreshing. You've brought a lot of positivity with you, which I've really enjoyed.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Have a good weekend coming up, and I hope we can keep in touch.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me, and hopefully I've delivered something of value that someone can take some utility away from. So yeah.
You certainly have. It's been excellent. Thanks very much.
Thanks, mate. Take care.
Thanks for joining us for this week's episode of Talking with Traders, sponsored by IG, a world-leading CFD provider. We really are privileged to have such a strong global provider of online trading services as our backer for this podcast series. Remember to subscribe for more episodes by clicking on the subscribe button of your favorite podcast app. Or if you're watching on YouTube, please subscribe to our YouTube channel, give us a thumbs up, and leave a comment. We welcome the engagement. Till next time.